Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. I know that a lot of people think Donald Trump is an accidental president and that his conduct is unprecedented in the annals of American history. But I think Jaron Cohen would probably disagree with you on that. He's written a book called Accidental Presidents, and you're seeking something here. What is it that you're seeking to discover by going through these people who were vice presidents and then suddenly found themselves in the hot seat unexpectedly?
Well, I think as I started writing it and the political zeitgeist became the kind of hysterical, hyperbolic thing that we see today, I became really captivated by this idea of asking the question, is politics today as bad as it seems? And I think if you look today at our current political zeitgeist and you believe that our politics are worse than any other time in history, the good news is I think you have a recency bias. In looking back on this history, the founding fathers didn't provide much of a guide for how to handle presidential succession. And despite 8 presidents dying in office and 19 close calls, we basically winged it. And despite having basically winged it, we managed to muddle through and navigate a path that left us more or less fine. You had Andrew Johnson, who was a disaster. But the other 7, while they had mixed results, we ended up just fine as a country.
Now, as you point out, Andrew Johnson comes off as the worst of the accidental presidents. And well, this is because he was determined to punish the South after the Civil War, right?
Well, what's interesting is I set out to, there's so much that's been written about Abraham Lincoln. And the thing that people always wonder with Lincoln is how could you put somebody who is such a disaster a heartbeat away from the presidency? And I love Abraham Lincoln. I collect Lincoln autographs. I have a lock of Lincoln's hair from the night of his assassination, which is weird until you see it. And I wanted to vindicate Lincoln's choice of Johnson. And there's a period of Andrew Johnson before he became president and before the Civil War ended, where he was revered in the North and treated as demonous in the South. He was the only Southern senator to stay loyal to the Union. He was basically Abraham Lincoln's political jack-in-the-box in the 1864 campaign. And it wasn't until the Civil War ended that the true Andrew Johnson, as the last president to own slaves, really made himself known. And he ended up resurrecting so many different elements of the Confederacy, which paved the way for the Black Codes, which then paved the way for what became known as the Jim Crow laws.
Where do you fall on the? There seems to be 2 schools of thought, of course, when it comes to history. There's the great man theory, which says that it all depends on the one person that happens to be in office at the right time, or the idea that there are natural forces which would have changed events no matter who was there. So where do you fall on that?
What I will say is, just given this current moment where people like to say somebody is the best president of all time or the worst president of all time, I would say that you can't be the best or the worst president without presiding over a context where your decisions, good or bad, have 100-plus year consequences. So, you know, this is why someone like Andrew Johnson can really have the status as the worst president in history. It's also why, you know, if you look at Teddy Roosevelt, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, much to his own detriment, he just didn't preside over very important consequential times. And as big a personality as he was, you know, that's what it took to be remembered during peacetime.
I think you believe that it's fortunate we didn't have a world crisis or any kind of war during while Teddy Roosevelt was president.
Well, as much as I love Teddy Roosevelt because of what a colorful, enigmatic and fascinating character he was, it put in today's context, he would really be viewed as a borderline lunatic. I mean, the man loved war. He loved blood. He loved conflict. He lusted after the idea of a war. And he eventually obviously fought in Cuba. But had he presided over a wartime context, there's no telling what he could have done. In the one day that the Secretary of Navy put him in charge because he went to go get massage therapy on his back, Teddy Roosevelt more or less took the country to war against Spain. And it was literally like half a day.
And we think Trump is unpredictable. Do you think that the country is set up to deal successfully with social media? Because it's like having moment-to-moment, real-time polling, essentially, right? I mean, you have somebody influential says something and makes a suggestion. It gets up to the president through back channels, not through official channels. He tweets about it, and the pace is just dizzying.
I think what's interesting is the accessibility of political figures to everyday people now. You know, it's interesting. I reflect back on there's a great story that I write about in The Accidental Presidents about the very first person to troll the president of the United States and get a response.
Right.
You think today about, you know, people randomly tweeting at President Trump and him, you know, retweeting or responding. But in 1881, after Garfield was assassinated and Chester Arthur ascended to the presidency, there was a woman who lived on the Upper East Side of Manhattan named Julia Sand. And she would write him these long form letters telling him what a terrible person he was, but he can still be salvaged, and comparing him to some of the sort of darkest characters in the court of King Henry VIII and so forth. And she wrote him 30 letters. And we know it had an impact on Arthur because one day he took his presidential carriage and showed up at her apartment on the Upper East Side, came inside and had a conversation with her.
Oh, my gosh.
So I cite this as the very first instance of a random person trolling the president and getting the president's attention.
Wow. Well, did he win her over?
What we know about their encounter comes from a subsequent letter that she wrote to him. And by all accounts, the whole experience sounded completely awkward.
Yeah, it's always dangerous to meet your trolls, but it's good. It's reassuring to know that this then is really nothing new. It's just a matter of degree.
People like to point to President Trump and say, you know, he's impulsive and reactive and we've never seen this before. And maybe that's the case on social media, but nothing compares to when John Tyler got kicked out of the Whig Party in 1841 after vetoing the national bank bill, and then the Democrats wouldn't welcome him with open arms, and he decided he was just super angry at everybody and he would annex Texas, precipitating war with Mexico. Or people like to say that, you know, we've never been so polarized, but that's also not true, because in 1850, Senator Henry Foote from Mississippi pulled a gun on Senator Thomas Hart Benton and tried to shoot and murder him right there in the Senate chamber. What followed was a bunch of members of the Senate punching each other, strangling each other, rolling around, and then getting back to business. Or even today, people like to point to the president's cabinet and say, we've never seen such musical chairs before. And that's also not true. Millard Fillmore, when he ascended to the presidency in 1850 upon the death of Zachary Taylor, took the oath of office and then fired the entire cabinet.
Well, now I won't be surprised by anything. So thank you for that.
But maybe we should have higher standards, right? Maybe what we should say, it's probably not good enough to say, you know, we're polarized right now, but at least nobody's shooting each other in Congress.
Exactly. Accidental Presidents, Eight Men Who Changed America, written by Jared Cohen. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's time for Choke Points Now, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. The first construction project funded by ST3 is about to turn dirt between Bothell and Kenmore. That's exciting, Chris.
Yeah, it is. It's a milestone. And it's one of the lanes, one of the things that we don't think about when we think of ST3. I know we all generally probably think, oh, light rail, long distance expansions. It's not going to be here, there.
Hundreds of dollars spent on car tabs.
Yes, exactly. But there are a lot of other transit projects that aren't related to light rail that are actually part of ST3. And some of them are going to get completed a lot sooner than you might think. And the first of these projects actually begins next week. It's going to complete the bus lanes that run along Highway 522 between Bothell and Kenmore. Right now, those lanes end, which forces the buses to merge in and out of regular traffic to make their stops to pick up or drop off passengers, and it can be very difficult for them to get back in to the queue. So this should improve transit times between Bothell and Seattle by about 15 minutes.
Completing this entire bat lane system along here is really going to give them a much clearer path to run. In addition to the speed, you get the reliability. They're much more able to show up on time, because they know they're going to be running at a much more constant speed in those bat lanes.
Sound Transit's Paul Cornish says delivering on ST3 projects is key to building out a reliable system.
It's a big win for Sound Transit. It's a big win for the local bus service. And it's a great example of us and the city of Bothell and the other agencies working together to make these early wins happen.
But before there can be gain, there will be pain. 18 months of it. Jason Torrey in Bothell's Public Works Department says you should expect lane closures, plenty of orange cones, and delays. But the city's working to keep that pain to a minimum. Most of the closures should be off-peak.
We're going to try to minimize that as much as possible. So in the morning and the evening commutes, we're not allowing any lane restrictions. Those will be done at night and during the midday portion of the day.
And it's not just buses getting all the love in this project.
We're going to be adding sidewalks on the westbound side of the road where there currently isn't any. And that's a big component because it's going to allow the whole neighborhood to the north side of the highway to be able to access the multimodal options that are available down here,
including the trail system that everybody loves to work through that area. And Tory says even drivers are going to get something out of this.
It's going to be safer. You're going to have wider lanes that meet standards. You're going to have better illumination and better signage out there. So I think it's a win-win for everybody involved.
This $30 million project is the largest road project in Bothell's history. You should expect heavy police enforcement as well of the bus lanes and the speed limit during construction. Everybody there trying to make sure that there's going to be a safe work zone. The construction on this begins on Monday.
And what's that supposed to do with traffic through the air? I was just driving through that area, actually. This is going to be really nice for that commute.
Yeah, but it's going to be good once they get through it. But it's right after that really steep bend in the road right by the old Wayne Golf Course there. So I'm expecting this to cause some significant backups getting from 405 into the Kenmore area, depending on how they set up those lane closures. So, yeah, this is something you're going to have to pay attention to. Even with these off-peak lane closures, there's still going to be so much there distraction-wise visually that it's going to have an impact on our drive through about the Christmas time of 2020.
Ooh. And really no way to avoid it.
No, not really.
Other than driving through neighborhoods.
Right. There really aren't many other alternatives to get to that unless you want to go over the top of Finn Hill, work your way down and get across. Not that I'm telling you to drive through people's neighborhoods or through the UW Bothell campus and work your way through downtown. So, yeah, there aren't a lot of great options.
I'm just laughing because your brain is a map of this region. It's amazing how you can pull that out and just go, all right, this is the alternative.
As I said, tell people I see the world like the Matrix.
Yes.
Just a bunch of squiggly green lines.
I couldn't take my eyes off it yesterday. I imagine the world also transfixed by those images of Notre Dame burning in the center of Paris. It was a glowing orange orb. It seemed at first the church would be lost, but much of it was saved. We're delighted to announce this morning. We called up CBS's Elaine Cobb in Paris to tell us what's left.
Colleen, a lot of the main structure is still standing. The stone shell, if you will, has survived, and those iconic bell towers were saved. That was very important for the firefighters, because not just for their historical and architectural value, but because of the incredibly heavy metal belt inside. Had they fallen, they would have smashed a lot more of the structure and caused a lot of damage in the area in front of the cathedral. But it's very strange looking at it. I'm standing behind it across the river, and the whole back is gone. Not seeing the spire on the skyline as we drove by was just so strange. The scaffolding that was erected for the renovation work, all the metal parts are still there, of course. The wood burned away completely. So it looks very forlorn, it has to be said.
What percentage of this structure would you say is gone or would need to be rebuilt, just to put it into perspective for those of us not there?
Well, the shell itself is there, so really it's a case of redoing all of the roofing. Officials say that there have been some weaknesses that they have seen. There are parts of the stonework that will need to be shored up. They will need to be reinforced. But a lot of the major architecture has survived. Inside, of course, they will have to redo an awful lot. And there's already about a foot of water that was poured in there by firefighters in an attempt to save the wooden interiors, to just make it too wet for the fire to take hold. They were in there early on and at one point thrown out because the police drone overhead said it is too dangerous. The fire is coming. That roof could come down on you. And then they sent in a robot with a water hose to continue.
Oh, very interesting. And I think the question on everyone's mind, Elaine, is what caused this?
That is something that Paris prosecutor's office say they are now going to investigate. They have opened a case for involuntary destruction and say they do not believe there was any malicious intent or any deliberate act. Some 50 experts and investigators will be involved in the case. The forensics teams were waiting until the structure cooled enough for them to go in and sift through the debris. The fire started in the roof, but they need to find out exactly what caused it, what sparked it, and if there was any link with the renovation work already underway.
The President Emmanuel Macron, he said he'll launch a nationwide fundraising effort to rebuild. I mean, that's resiliency in action right there. No surprise from the Parisian people. Is that fundraising effort already underway?
Well, he has promised to organize a fundraising effort, but even before he got to do that, several local authorities offered to donate money. Several wealthy businessmen said they would give money. So already there's more than $500 million pledged, some from some of the big companies here. And they expect to get a lot more. And Macron said we will also be taking the fundraising effort international, because he said, you know, people love this around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, no shortage of pictures of everyone who's visited. It's beloved, even if you're not somebody who is particularly religious. It just seems to be, aside from the Eiffel Tower, that is an iconic image in Paris.
You know, it's the heart of Paris, literally, geographically, and figuratively. This was the point from which all points in France are measured, right in front of Notre Dame. And this is also the very starting part of Paris. It was first built on the Ile de la Cité and the Ile Saint-Louis just behind it where I am.
CBS News correspondent Elaine Cobb joining us from Paris. It's time for your daily dose of kindness. It's about a good kid. He was looking out for his mom and his city, in a way, when the 12-year-old took matters into his own hands. For the story, here's CBS's Steve Hartman.
So what's 14T plus 8T?
For middle school parents like Trinell Scott, algebra homework is often the easy part.
Good.
The tougher part of parenting is figuring out what your kid is off doing when the homework's done.
No.
Monty says he didn't tell his mom.
I didn't tell nobody.
Of all the things to find out your kid's doing behind your back.
Yeah.
It could be worse.
Right. He saw a need, and he felt like he could meet that need, so that's why he did what he did.
Trinell says it all started one day when she was driving around her hometown of Muskegon Heights, Michigan. The road was a moonscape of potholes. One crater so deep it took out her tire and axle. Monty was mad.
Why did it bother you so much?
Because I didn't want to see nobody else messing with their car like my mom did.
Shortly after, this video popped up on Trinell's Facebook feed.
This little boy is out here fixing the streets.
Someone had recorded her 12-year-old son filling potholes. Trinell was shocked, but not surprised.
He's just a kid that likes to help people. If it's the fall, he's raking leaves. Summer, spring, he's cutting grass. Winter, he's blowing snow.
You get paid for that?
No.
Why not?
I tell myself I have a responsibility of doing something to help the community out.
Where'd you learn that?
My mom.
Well, we want to celebrate you.
For parenting at that high level, Mayor Kimberly Sims honored Trinell at a recent council meeting. She also cited Monty for his road work.
Thank you so much.
We commend him for his heart and just being able to assist us with that, but that should not have been something that he was concerned with.
Mayor Sims admits her town has a pothole problem.
And shame on us as elected officials if we don't take this opportunity to do something about that.
You a young hero, man, for real.
In the meantime, Monty isn't waiting on bureaucracy. He's still out there, filling holes in his neighborhood.
What's he filling these holes with?
Dirt.
From where?
The backyard.
A great son and a future pond. What more can a mom ask for?
That's a pothole.
Steve Hartman, on the road.
Look at this.
In Muskegon Heights, Michigan.
Time for your Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle, brought to you by Western Washington Toyota Dealers. It's Danny O'Neill. You can hear him weekdays at 3 on Danny, Dave, and more.
Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning.
Happy Russell Wilson contract.
Did you wake up to the sultry sounds of Russell Wilson counting his cash?
Hey, I woke Seattle. We got a deal.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.
Oh, yeah. I'm making money.
It's so weird. That's weird.
It is weird.
I threw up in my mouth again.
No,
stop it.
Why did he ruin a special moment with that?
It's weird.
Hey, Seattle. We got a deal.
Oh, yeah. I can't handle
it,
Danny.
It's weird.
Okay.
It's strange.
Aside from the distracting video, what are the details we know about this contract?
4 years, average of $35 million, bringing it to $140 million. He got the largest single signing bonus that an NFL player has ever gotten. And that was near $70 million. I believe it was $69 million. Yeah, that's a large. Do you think they write that in one check? Or do you think it goes direct deposit?
I would want them to write it in one check.
I'd want it on paper just so I could see all the numbers and go into the bank and go, yeah, I'd like to cash this.
An NBA player that I knew a little bit, Jerry Stackhouse, he had it stipulated in his contract that he got his entire year's salary, which at the time was $4 or $5 million, all in one lump sum. Like at the beginning of the season. And I remember him telling me, he goes, they had to give me two checks because they weren't allowed to write one that big.
That's and great.
I remember thinking to myself, like, imagine being so rich, like you were entertained by the method in which you were paid.
I think I'm past the point where I go, oh, it's too much money. Da, da, da. You know, I'm past the point of complaint. But I see people today even going, well, time for him to, you know, call it in as if earning a little bit more millions is going to make him lazy all of a sudden. I don't think that's the case with him.
No, that's certainly, I would say this, with Russell Wilson, you don't worry about an extra salary spike affecting the way he prepares.
He's already making millions.
He puts a lot, and to his credit, he puts a lot of money into his body with the nutritionist, with the training he does, the focus, the mental coaching. Like, he invests a lot in himself and has been different in that way from the very beginning.
What's with the trend of blaming outside factors for an athlete's performance, like the wife or the girlfriend or the money? Doesn't he have his own agency in how he performs?
Sure. He absolutely does. The money is a legitimate question.
Yeah.
How will money change a player? That's absolutely a legitimate question. How does someone go from, but if they're chasing, Aaron Curry was one of the biggest draft busts in this franchise's history. And he's said himself that one of the issues was once he became the number four overall pick, once the Seahawks drafted him, he had achieved his goal. His goal and was focused around, I want to become a top five draft pick and secure my financial future and my family's financial future. And once you got that, how does that affect not how you prepare, how you prepare, but your focus and level of that? The thing about wives, and this is something Russell has run into specifically, the idea, and people will point to it, the effect a wife has on an athlete's decision making, or Giselle, on Tom Brady, or references to Yoko Ono. I think that's really gross and lame. Mm-hmm. I think that viewing a couple and saying, like, oh, she's changed him, they've changed together. Mm-hmm. Couples, there's no doubt that couples have impacts on each other, but the idea of blaming some sort of outside factor is awful.
Where's the pressure then to deliver on another Super Bowl because of this race?
Yeah, certainly that's there. That's the expectation. That's the hope.
Next year?
I don't think it's any different than, well, sure, yes. They should start every season with the belief that they can be a Super Bowl contender.
I mean, how soon will we wait before we go, it wasn't worth it?
Well, the idea of worth, you're paying for a quarterback who is going to get you to the playoffs annually. That's what a reasonable expectation is.
All right.
Is that you should, with Russell Wilson there, contend for a playoff spot every single year.
All right, so who's not going to get paid and who do we lose because of this money?
Well, this sets in motion a lot of different decisions. Frank Clark is the loser today because if Russell Wilson had not gotten a deal, Seattle would have faced the possibility of having to franchise tag him next year, which would have meant if Frank Clark played this year on a franchise tag at $17 million, he would have been a free agent next year. Frank doesn't have that exit that he can eye right now. So that changes the nature of his discussions with the team. Also, Bobby Wagner, I think that's going to be a more straightforward extension. I would expect an extension to get done with him probably right about the time training camp starts in that neighborhood. And then the other one is Jaron Reed, who's a defensive lineman who took a huge step forward. I don't think that Russell Wilson's contract is necessarily going to cost them a player, but it does, if anything, it's going to increase the pressure on players to want to get a long-term extension done because they know that the possibility of the franchise tag is hanging out there, which it wouldn't have been if Russell hadn't got this deal.
Mm. I hate to be Captain Bringdown, but it sounds like the Mariners are on a losing streak.
Yeah, they are. They've hit the skids a little bit. They're not scoring quite like they used to.
Mm.
I don't believe that the bottom is falling out. I don't believe that they're crash landing and all of a sudden going to be, next thing you know, have a losing record.
That it was a fluke that they won so many games.
It was unprecedented. I mean, that was unusual. Do I think that they're going to win 13 of 15 again this season? No, I don't think they're going to have another run of 13 wins in 15 games because that is so high a rate. I still think they're going to finish with a winning record. I don't know if that's going to be good enough to get them in the playoffs, but I think it's a really positive sign for this team.
Fair enough. You know who is going to the playoffs?
Who?
Hey, Seattle. We got a deal.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.
Oh, yeah. Do you think when he posts it, he's like, I'm the man?
I don't know what he's thinking.
Because I might feel that way.
It is so intimate. I'm uncomfortable.
Maybe I'll start posting selfie videos from my bed at night. Hey, Seattle.
Please
get
do.
Up tomorrow. Sports Insider.
Oh, with yeah. Peach. By Sharpay.
Yeah!
Thank you, Danny.
Talk to you soon.
Seattle is a step closer to being able to use traffic cameras to bus drivers who block intersections or use bus-only lanes. This bill we thought was dead in Olympia, but it's been resurrected.
Yeah, so it missed a key cutoff several weeks ago. And here's what you, if you cover the legislature, you always find out, even if a bill is dead, nothing is really ever dead in the legislature.
If you cover the legislature. You're the only one that covers the legislature,
No,
Hannah.
Sully knows this. Nothing is ever
That's
dead.
That's all she does, really.
Just this time of year.
It's her passion.
At any rate, it was revived. Democratic Representative Joe Fitzgibbon had told me a week or so ago that he was trying to get some new life into this, and he was successful very late last night. As it did come up in the House, a little bit revised, but they got it passed.
The changes that we made were to make the traffic safety cameras a 2-year pilot project. So we'll have 2 years for the city of Seattle to deploy these cameras and then report back to the legislature about how they worked and how they improved mobility, how they improved safety, what level of traffic revenue they generated, traffic fine revenue. The amendment also puts half of the revenue from traffic fines into the state highway safety account for use for projects throughout the state that improve safety.
So they moved around where this money is going to go this time in these amendments that came down last night. And he stresses the goal here is not about bringing in new revenue.
No. The city of Seattle has always been really clear with me that they don't really care what we do with the money. They just want to be able to enforce the law for these purposes. So that was where the idea came from, to use some of the revenue for the state highway safety fund. So it's a 2-year project, and we're going to see after 2 years how effective it is, assuming the bill passes the Senate, see how effective it is in ensuring the traffic keeps moving through downtown Seattle. And then we'll have to decide if we want to continue it or not. But the goal here is not to generate money. The goal is to make sure that people follow the law.
Yeah, okay. If they are so passionate about following the law, are they pledging to also ticket bus drivers who are major contributors to blocking the box?
So I asked this question specifically for Sully, and here's the answer I got.
We don't target them specifically, no, but certainly as the transit lanes are more open, then we think buses will be blocking the box less often.
So essentially,
so no.
Once we get all the, no.
So city is immune to the rules.
Well, Metro.
Metro.
King County. Those who work for the city or the county are immune to the rules.
Pretty much. That cool. The other thing you won't do that will not be people who block the box. Well, the pedestrians.
No.
Who cross.
Because they have no license plate. We covered that. Yeah,
exactly. So two of the major contributors to blocking the box are exempt, except drivers are.
So you're not a fan of this, Sully?
No. I believe blocking the box, if you're going to enforce it, it should be enforced on everyone. Buses, cars, delivery trucks, bikes, pedestrians. It should be fair across the board. Now, that said, the buses wouldn't have to block the box if cars were a little bit better. I get that. But I think I'm in favor of laws that apply to everybody, mm-hmm. or else the public just gets mad about it.
This is a transit-based city. And look, it's like the needs of the many over the needs of the fewer the one, right? You've got all these people on this bus who are always being delayed because of various vehicles, single occupancy vehicles that are blocking the box, that kind of thing. And they need to keep those buses moving. There's no one has, from the mayor on down, has made any secret about the fact that that is their number one goal here when it comes to transit in the city. I will point out, though, this bill is, in 5 years, you get a warning the first time, essentially. Mm-hmm. So the ticket's going to be about $130. You get a warning the first time out, and that's for 5 years. So a second violation in 5 years, then you'll get the actual ticket. The first time, though, during this pilot program, you should just get a warning.
And it's not just for downtown Seattle, though, this pilot.
No, it is not just for downtown Seattle. As a matter of fact, it'll affect a few larger areas around the city.
Traffic safety cameras to enforce bus lanes and enforce block-the-box infractions in downtown Seattle, as well as in non-interstate freeways connecting to downtown Seattle and arterials that connect with those freeways. So that means the West Seattle Bridge and SR-99, and then arterials that connect with those freeways. So in my district, that's Avalon Way, Fauntleroy Way, Del Ridge Way, as well as in Northwest Seattle, in areas that connect to Aurora. Those arterials would be covered as well.
So the upset about
so the redheaded stepchild of Seattle, which is known as West Seattle, gets screwed again. Because it looks like all of those routes for everybody getting out of West Seattle, the neighborhood that everyone forgot, even though it's one of the biggest
But the buses are going to be moving.
Don't fan the flames quite yet. This is just out of the House.
Yes.
Okay. It still has to pass the Senate. Then, you know, there's a lot to do.
And he thinks that there's a very solid chance it will pass in the Senate. Look, I do want to point out, though, when this first started, there was a version in the House and in the Senate. Both of them would have been statewide, right? So this is pared down. It's now just Seattle and now just a two-year pilot program. He thinks it's got a good chance in the Senate. I'll keep you posted.
I'm in favor of anything that makes Seattle driving less confusing and stressful. And I feel like this is going to add to the stress.
I'm not sure that's it.
Yeah. The way we have these diagonal roads and I can't do it. I'm a country mouse, Hannah. It's time for our weekly chat with the Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, David Fahrenthold. David, congratulations, too, on more Pulitzer Prizes for The Washington Post. They were just released this week.
That's right. Not me, but three of my colleagues won Pulitzer Prizes yesterday.
Yeah, wonderful news. It's a good time to be a journalist. So what do you think the odds are we're going to see the president's taxes?
Not anytime soon. They've made it clear that they will fight tooth and nail and, you know, not abide by the letter of the law to avoid people seeing the president's taxes. So I don't think we'll see them anytime soon, unless we see them in New York State, which is making a separate, where Democrats are making a separate effort to get them.
Oh, I see. And as somebody who's invested years of reporting on the president's finances, what would you be looking for in those returns?
A couple of things. I would be looking for sources of funding, if we could learn anything about where, if he has any outside sources of funding that we haven't been told about. I'd also be looking to see, you know, how much money he has, how much cash he has on hand, how much he gives to charity. There's lots of things about Trump's finances where the only authority we have is Donald Trump, and that's proven to be pretty unreliable authority about things like this.
Amongst the Democratic candidates, tax returns are being tossed around like candy at a parade. What are we learning from those returns?
Well, the most important thing we learned today, well, we learned a couple of things. One, Bernie Sanders is a millionaire. People may have expected that. He sold a pretty well-selling book last time around. But also how little the other candidates give to charity. Now, remember, I wrote a whole series of stories in 2016 about President Trump's promises to give to charity that were often not followed up on. We still don't know actually how much he gives to charity because he hasn't released his tax returns. But other Democratic candidates have started releasing their returns, and we're seeing some pretty low amounts of giving to charity. I think federal work is less than 1% of his income to charity. That's something that may just be content tailored just to me, but I found that very interesting.
And why is that? I mean, do we expect somebody over a certain threshold of income to give generously to charity?
Well, it sort of goes along with the public mindset that makes you a candidate, in theory. Right? If you're going to run for president, you must care about your fellow man, want to do things to help them, see there are worthy causes in the world you want to support. And if you're not doing that with your own personal money, maybe the argument is, well, I pay taxes and that should, you know, be all the good I do in the world. But if you don't see a need and it's crying out for your own personal money, it's sort of hard to convince people that they should put their efforts and time into sort of supporting those causes through your campaign.
Sure. And remind us again, because I think that there's still enough people out there who don't give a rip about a candidate's tax returns and perhaps about President Trump's tax returns. Certainly his base doesn't seem to care. Remind us historically why this precedent was set.
Well, presidents have been releasing their tax returns since the 1970s. And for the reasons we described, you know, we want to know what causes they support, how much they give to charity, but also just so we understand financially, do they, the policies they might benefit from, the tax brackets they're in, and also the sources of their income, their business partners, all those things would help us understand the context around them, who they would like to help, how they might help themselves by being president. So you need to know a lot about a president before you understand that they're really acting in the public interest and not in their self-interest. Tax returns help you do that.
Yeah. Of the many, many Democrats who are running for president, who is standing out to you as a candidate who might have a shot?
Well, the person who seems to be, I mean, first of all, Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden seem to be the front runners in all the polls we're looking at. The person who surprised me the most in the last couple of weeks has been Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, mm-hmm. a really, really unlikely place for a Democratic or any presidential candidate to come from. But he's doing what Trump did, which is he'll be on any TV show, any radio show, anybody that'll have him, you know, he'll take the free media. So he's been on everything from the Ellen Show to TMZ to everything the last few weeks. And I think it's made a pretty compelling case to a lot of Democrats. You're seeing him sort of vault into the top of that lower tier. Everybody below Bernie and Biden is like below 10% in the polls, but Buttigieg is at the top of that lower tier. He's like at 9%, which is really standing out.
I'm really curious. I asked CBS's Stephen Portnoy earlier in the show about this because we know Governor Jay Inslee well here around Washington State, but I don't know how you know D.C. is reacting to him or anybody else out there in America. What's your take on Governor Inslee?
Well, he starts from a low base of name recognition, and Inslee's chosen a strategy of focusing on one issue. I care only about climate change, or I want to talk only about climate change. But given the magnitude of the threat from climate change, it makes a lot of sense. I think he's, you know, there's a huge number of people in that sort of second tier, from Buttigieg on down to Andrew Yang, congressmen, senators, all kinds of people. And it's hard to stand out in that group. And I think Inslee's problem so far seems to be that he hasn't had as much public exposure. He hasn't done as much to get his name out there. Maybe we'll see that coming. But I feel like I know his name, and I know that one policy position. That's really the only thing I know about it now. Hmm.
And there's actually a Republican in the race now, too, for the White House. What do we know about Bill Weld?
Well, he's not going to win. Okay. That's probably the most important thing.
That was the same reaction Stephen had, too.
Yeah, he used to be the governor of Massachusetts, a Republican governor of Massachusetts, very popular back in the 90s. He then moved to New York and I think ran for Senate out of New York State. But he's a very liberal Republican. He's also been out of the game a long time. Most recently heard from is Gary Johnson's running mate in 2016. He's in the Republican Party of today, animated by Trump, and before him animated by people like Paul Ryan. Bill Weld is basically a nobody. He's a Republican, you know, he's got some, you know, he's a party member of their party, but otherwise he doesn't come in with many advantages.
What, does he have a book to sell? What's his angle?
I think he just likes to be prominent. I mean, right. You know, somebody, there's people want there to be an anti-Trump in the Republican primary, and I think Bill Weld doesn't have a lot to lose, so why not get in and see if it works?
Sure, why not? Be the bait dog.
The real serious candidate would be somebody like Larry Hogan from Maryland or Charlie Baker from Massachusetts. You know, somebody who's really running something now and has won an election since 2016. Based on something other than Donald Trump's philosophy. If you got that, maybe you got a chance.
All right. So David Farenthold from The Washington Post. We talk to him every Tuesday. Thank you, David.
Thank you.